you missed Wednesday's Enterprise, this weekend there's another chance to get on board. An enemy from the past closes in.
They have us surrounded.
And the crew is at their mercy.
No!
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton picking up traces of bread pudding.
And we're here this week to talk about Shockwave.
Yeah, Cam, this is Enterprise's very first cliffhanger.
Shockwave.
I can't believe Star Trek's never had an episode called Shockwave before.
Can you think of other stories that have used the title Shockwave? I only got one.
Stories? You mean like TV episodes?
Sure, anything. Has that title been used a lot in media that you've consumed?
I can't say so.
Yeah, I can only think of really two good uses. Clive Cussler used it as the title of a Dirk Pitt novel, and Limp Bizkit downloaded the Shockwave for all the ladies in the cave to get their groove on.
Well, now that everybody's tuned out, we can get into the action here, which is the very first cliffhanger that Star Trek Enterprise ever did. I remember looking at the episode name, I'm like, oh, this is going to be action heavy.
Yeah,
be Shockwave. Prepared. Yeah. I have very different feelings on parts one and two on this, and I think we often try to look at it holistically and see if this justifies itself as a two-parter. Mm-hmm. I will say this, it has been near 20 years since I first saw this, and I have to say that I found it a rather weak part one, and I found it a much stronger part two, and that genuinely surprises me, because I think our consensus is that the part one episodes for Star Trek, they're usually much stronger. They have a lot of the setup, they give you a lot more time with the characters, where it seems as if they kind of go into a high-speed mode for part two to wrap everything up, and they're a lot more story-based. And I found it almost just the opposite for my experience. What was your experience taking these one-two punch recently, Cam?
I think that's really interesting, because I actually was more into part one than I was in part two.
Okay.
And so we'll have an interesting back and forth then on this one.
Well, just for anybody who doesn't remember, essentially this is the next phase of the Temporal Cold War. Essentially, the Enterprise's mission is canceled when they seemingly cause an explosion on, guess what, Cam? A mining colony.
Yes.
Who knew that they were into mining colonies in Star Trek? So they're called back, and it's up to Archer to prove the innocence of the NX-01 here. And we get the return of Daniels. We get more Suliban mythology and, of course, Future Guy, and a great performance from John Fleck as Silic, just screaming for Future Guy to come back to him.
But
some interesting things going on here.
Yes, it definitely was. Do you remember at the time when you saw this, like, did it have an impact, or were you just kind of like, more Enterprise isn't really clicking with me?
More Enterprise not really clicking with me. I thought there was so much potential behind kind of this idea. I was a little bit more on board with the Temporal Cold War. I was just kind of curious about the mystery. Mm-hmm. And then as we went further and further along with it, it became very clear they didn't really have any sort of plan. None of the plans made sense with regards to what the Suliban were enacting, and it seemed as if the Suliban were more just kind of tools and puppets, and I wasn't invested in them so much at this point. The one image that really did stick with me, though, is when we have Daniels and Archer at the very end looking upon, you know, kind of this ancient desecrated version of San Francisco.
That is what stuck with me as well.
But you didn't have to sit on it for a summer. You just went and tuned in on the next episode on Netflix, or you pulled in another disc.
I wasn't Netflix. It was DVD at that point. But yeah, I was flipped right to the next disc. Like at the time, I really did enjoy this one, but I also remember it not having the impact on me that other Star Trek two-parters would, where TNG, DS9, you tended to have a lot of thoughts about them, whether you liked them or not. You know, one like, past tense, maybe didn't click with me hugely the first time through, but I never forgot it.
Yeah.
Whereas like Shockwave, it's one where every time I've like seen it, I'm like, what happens in that one again? Like the actual incidents tied to it, I find very tough to remember. Like I always remember, as you said, the desiccated like planet, Earth in the 31st century. I always remember that, but I don't tend to remember a lot of things tied around it other than, Yeah, there's a lot of temporal Cold War stuff.
Yeah, that's really what stuck to me most. So there's a lot of stuff. I was actually questioning whether I'd put in the right episode on my Blu-ray.
You were just watching Night in Sick Bay on a repeat?
Well, it's like I was waiting for like kind of the action to kick in, because all I remembered was that this is a temporal Cold War heavy episode. And they're talking a lot about, this planet's a matriarchy. I guess I better be careful down there. That's my best Trip impersonation. Yeah.
I liked how he's just like, a matriarchy, huh?
Yeah, just like, I was just like, oh, they are going to say something really stupid that's not going to age well. And I was like, okay.
Not as much as you would maybe have expected, though.
Sure, yeah. And I was just waiting for the shoe to drop, and it didn't quite happen. I think what did he conclude? That he should stop, or he shouldn't try to flirt with the women so much?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, yeah, probably a good idea just in general there, Mr. Space Explorer from Earth.
Exactly, yeah.
So, but the thing is, I keep waiting, like, when is the temporal Cold War stuff, like, going to take place? And
right.
You wait, and you wait, and you wait, and then you finally have, like, Daniels appear. It's actually kind of an interesting sequence when we finally kick into action with, you know, Archer waking up the day before Klang the Klingon appears from Broken Bow. And I was like, okay, this is actually kind of an interesting sequence.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, I had a thought as I was watching Daniels pop into this scene. Is Daniels Enterprise's Q? Because in a lot of ways, he serves the same function. He's a sort of character who has a lot of time, like an omniscient point of view on events. And he's there mostly to really sell how incredible the captain is.
Well, I would say that you're giving him a little bit too much credit.
I don't think he was necessarily as well written as a Q, but was that, does he kind of play that same type of function?
No, because I would argue that Q is more antagonistic.
I agree.
Daniels is not necessarily kind of the antagonistic function. Like, I would say you could find similarities between him and Q for sure, but I wouldn't compare them necessarily. I would say you can make a stronger argument that maybe the Prophets are Deep Space Nine's version of Q to a certain degree.
Right. I don't know. The thing about Daniels is he plays such a huge role though in guiding the story, which feels like a very Q thing too, because they have this ability to have the knowledge of where things are going, so they can very much guide the captain while making the captain realize his true potential, which is, you know, very much selling the Archer / Picard as a legend.
Yeah. So anyways, like Archer, he comes back from this kind of time travel event. And this is where I start to get a little bit lost in the episode, because I my problem with part one, though, is for the first, 30 minutes, you see that things keep happening to the crew.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't have any agency here. It's how did we make this planet explode? Or now we're getting, you know, our mission canceled. Things just keep happening. They're kind of mopey, understandably so. I'd be bummed out here.
I kind of like that, though, because you get really good character moments. Like, I love the T'Pol and Phlox talking about how Archer's dealing with, like, the grief over this situation that's happened.
I agree. You get some character moments out of this, but from a storytelling perspective, I don't think it's very... Just to see your characters as inactive agents.
But they're trying to figure out, though, what happened. Like, there's the mystery element of them trying to crack the case. Like, how did this happen? Because I love how many times Reed has to mention the ducks.
Well, you know what? How did this happen? They don't have a clue. They were never going to figure it out until Daniels comes around.
Yeah.
And it's Deus Ex Machina Daniels, if we want to call him that. There. Right. So it's yet another outside figure is pulling the strings yet again. Because I actually did kind of like what happened, though. It's like Archer comes back with all this knowledge in which he's able to find a stealth ship, for example, from the Suliban. Yeah. Then they go into action and they start kind of getting back data disks. And I'll tell you what, nobody foresaw cloud computing becoming a thing in the 2001, 2002 when Enterprise premiered, because fetching data disks from a spaceship in the 22nd century, I don't think that's necessarily going
to
be a thing.
At the time, like, Bragg and Berman were listening to mini disks, and they were like, disks, man, what can't they do?
Yeah. I mean, so I do appreciate, like, we get to see Archer, after 30 minutes of him being kind of a passive agent, we get to see him go into action. And I thought we got some cool sequences out of that myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, everything where they're going to find the stealth craft is really cool. Like, I did really enjoy them, going through and having to knock out the Sulaban with like the concussion grenades.
Yeah, did you notice all of them happen to be crawling on the ceiling?
Which is amazing. It's so like I know Brendan Bragg is a huge horror guy, and I'm like, is this like an Aliens thing? Because there's a famous shot of all the aliens on the ceiling. And I know Braga draws so much stuff from those old like Fangoria classics and as well as Aliens. But I mean,
I was just wondering about the practicality
of it. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Like, it's so goofy. But at the same time, I'm like, that's really kind of cool. Like, it's something you wouldn't necessarily think of in just your typical sci-fi show. Like, Star Wars hasn't done that yet.
Wait for the Mandalorian, man. Everything takes place upside down. So,
or the final fight in Rise of the Skywalker. Yeah, it'll just be all on the ceiling.
The gravity boots, bro. Can't wait. Yeah, so look, I also kind of think that Sulaban sequence was a well-done action sequence. The ladder that Archer has to go up onto that secondary platform within the ship makes absolutely no sense, because you can get up that ladder, but it's very clear based on how Scott Bakula gets down that no man has been to get down this ladder. It seemed like the most impractical thing ever made. I got a good laugh out of that myself.
Are you saying a rickety ladder in the Star Trek two-parter?
And that connects to a platform. Star Trek, you love your platforms and ladders, that's for sure.
They really do. I think my favorite part of this whole thing, though, is when they're in the shuttle and they're trying to get away and they're pulling at the connecting tube or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And they have to break it loose and you see the little Sulaban bodies fall out.
You love that. You were talking all about that in Broken Bow. You wanted to see the CGI bodies go, wee!
Yeah. I just loved it because it's like the perfect moment of just like them ripping loose these two little CG bodies just plummeting out.
It's a dark Star Trek, you know.
It's one of my favorite things, though. It's like something that you see in like old serials a lot, too.
I was thinking about like, okay, so if it's the 24th century, you could hope that if it happened to, say, some Romulans, that maybe their ship would beam them back in time.
Sure.
Transporter technology not as ubiquitous, so it's right. Like, sorry, Sulaban, like, you're dying in the worst way possible. I would never want to die in outer space.
No, although they were just going straight downwards, so I don't know. It would be a little quicker, hopefully.
Hopefully. Were they? I thought they
were... fell directly downwards, so I don't know.
But they were in an outer space, though.
Were they?
Yeah.
Weren't they? I thought they were on the planet.
I thought they had aimed weapons at like kind of that stealth ship. I think it was more they weren't getting like blown out of the tube though. Like they were. I think the reason they went down though is just because of the angle that we were seeing. Like because to me, like it wasn't like they were. If you see how fast they were going,
right?
They weren't getting like pulled down by gravity or anything like that.
Right. Right.
So, but.
Let's talk more about the physics of the Sulaban falling.
You're the one who brought it up.
It's true.
Yeah.
And I'll bring it up again, I'm sure.
But there's a conversation that we had with regards... you were talking about the small moments. Maybe that's what we can like focus on as well. But one of the small moments that I did enjoy, though, is Hoshi and Mayweather contemplating their future if the Enterprise mission was canceled. Hoshi's just like, well, hey, remember, I'm a prodigy. They're going to take me back, no problem. And
yeah.
Mayweather, I understand. He's like saying, well, you know what? Spending a year on like this Warp 5 ship out in deep space, you know, being like a cargo runner again, it just kind of doesn't have the same appeal. And she said, well, you're going to be the most famous boomer around. Did you buy that as kind of an explanation? Do you think she was just trying to cheer him up after she was like humble bragging about her own career?
Okay, well, I totally think she was trying to cheer him up, because then he said, well, but everyone back home just thinks we're causing problems. And she goes, you'll be there to correct them.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody's going to be listening to him. You know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I love that. It just felt like the ultimate, just like, they're there.
Could you imagine as Travis as the captain kind of role? Do you think, like, he was kind of known as kind of the ace pilot? It was a bit of a steal for Archer to get him recruited from the Earth Cargo Service. What about him commanding at this point, 1 year into this mission? Do you think that you could imagine, like, a Captain Travis the Boomer series?
Oh my
god. I mean,
no.
An adventure though. Like, or could you imagine this man picking up and you know, captaining his own cargo vessel at this point at which we know him?
The thing is, in terms of the idea of that character, sure, maybe, but like the way he's written and portrayed on the show, I never have the insight or the grasp on him to be able to picture that. You know what I mean? Like, you can say in a, you know, a random Star Trek series, oh, you know, like, Chakotay's going to become a captain or, you know, whatever. Tuvok will move up in the ranks. And you're like, yeah, I can kind of see that. I've spent a lot of time with them. Whereas, like, Mayweather is such a perfunctory character a lot of the time, sitting there going like, aye, aye, captain. I mean, I guess, but there's nothing compelling about that concept.
Yeah, I think, but my biggest disappointment, though, is that he, despite having traveled more than anyone else on the ship, he wasn't there to say, hey, you know what? This is the planet where X happens or, you know, that happens. You know, I wish he could have been more of kind of the guide to a certain degree. But would that have taken something away from, say, Archer? Like, I would have to imagine that maybe Phlox has traveled as well. You didn't have Phlox dropping in to do an exposition bomb on the crew every time they encountered a new species so much, you know?
No, that's true. But you did get Phlox. We just talked about it last week, talking about the Tribbles. You know, like, Phlox would pipe in and often talk about different alien customs. Why couldn't they just give Mayweather, like, a scene or two of this on the bridge when they actually encounter something? We know that he did reference the Deltons in the episode Bound, so he is capable of delivering that type of, you know, dialogue, that kind of backstory for alien cultures. Why not have him on the bridge be like, I know these ships. They have fast maneuvering capabilities or something like that. You know, like, it can even be tech-based.
Well, I'm going to pitch you the Travis Mayweather show. It's, okay. He goes to the Earth Cargo Service. He's just like, okay, guys, I got the best trade route. Hook me up. I will captain to the Delton home planet. There and back just all the time. Just give me all the cargo you need. And we just watch him go back and forth between planets. You know,
the ship like takes off and they're like, hey, we forgot to put on the cargo. He's like, don't care.
Yeah. So the other stuff that kind of pops out to me, though, is the Suliban stuff was interesting. And then remember, they realize that they're completely surrounded by that swarm of Suliban.
Like a swarm of bees.
Well, I was thinking very much like I kind of got vibes out of Star Trek Beyond there. And it's been a while since I've seen this one. So it's just like
Beyond.
That's what they should have named the episode, the movie. That's so stupid.
There's a lot of good buzz for that movie.
Wow. Okay. I bet my biggest disappointment here is that we didn't have, you know, sabotage plane over the PA system. It would have been like T'Pol just like thumbing through the console and like just rocking out to Beastie Boys.
And just given the time period, maybe she would have done like the record scratch at that point.
I can imagine that. Yeah, great. Data disc scratch. You know, but Archer, in this moment though, he does have like a good farewell to the crew. Like he's like, oh, I have to give myself up to the Suliban in order to save my ship. Okay, I'll do it. Although his goodbye to Hoshi is like, you need to take care of my dog. And I'm just like, okay.
And no cheese.
Yeah.
Now, the whole cheese thing is kind of interesting to me because, like, I've had dogs most of my life. It would never occur to me to give them cheese.
No. I would only ever feed, like, our family dog either dog food or sometimes, you know, throw them a piece of turkey after Thanksgiving.
Sure.
You know?
Like, our dogs really like cucumber, so I would, like, throw them a piece of cucumber.
It's something easy on their stomach, though.
Yeah.
Like, because, honestly, there's nothing worse than a sick dog, and so you want to be careful with what you feed them.
I remember one time my dog ate a jalapeno pepper that was in a Quiznos package, and it was just, like, in, like, the fetal position on the couch going, like, for like hours.
I can imagine that.
It was not poor dog.
Yeah. That's also Hoshi when she eats a jalapeno pepper. That's why Archer had to warn her before that.
But I always wonder about that because it's such an odd detail that Archer's constantly like, no cheese, no cheese. It's like, why is this dog getting so much access to cheese?
There's some owners where the dog rules the house.
Sure.
I think maybe Porthos is the one running that small cabin that Archer's got there.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So, what did you think about him? Do you think that enough time has passed with this crew? It's been about a year on this mission. That's, you know, it seemed like a genuine goodbye that he was giving to like people that he had come to trust.
We've talked in the past how it took them quite a while to nail down the Archer character and to kind of find their way into him, like what makes him dynamic, like all the other captains. But I think you're starting to see it here where Archer's in many ways kind of like the sensitive captain. Like he gives these very earnest speeches to his crew that don't have the same level of like Shakespearean delivery of like a Picard or a Sisko or even a Kirk. Whereas like his is much more of like a heart to heart kind of delivery, and he feels much more grounded emotionally.
Yeah.
And I like his goodbye because it kind of touches on that, and you can see how he has like an emotional connection to the crew.
Well, even he says to Paul at one point, you know, you're somebody I rely on, you're somebody I trust. And you would not have said that about that relationship after the end of Broken Bow.
No, he would not.
So, I think you're kind of hard on to Paul in that episode. In that, like,
no, I think the writers were hard on to Paul in that episode.
Yeah, but, I mean, she wasn't acting like what she interpreted his commands to be. So, right. Like, I do give her credit for that. I think to Paul had... a lot to overcome as a character before, you know, we both came to fully appreciate her.
And oh, for sure.
She turned out to be like one of the best characters on Enterprise, which is not something that I would have necessarily said based on Broken Bow.
Is she the best character on Enterprise?
I'm trying to think about, like, by the time I felt around like season four, you can make a very strong argument that she may have been my favorite character at this point. I think,
yeah. You
know, that likability factor goes to Trip. For sure.
Mm-hmm. He's definitely like the fan favorite type character.
Yeah. I would say that they did a lot with Phlox in season three that I really, really liked. And they just didn't keep that thread going into season four. And I think if they did give him like a lot more material going into the next season, you could have made a very strong argument for Phlox by season four. So Paul might have like, well, I'll make the argument. T'Pol probably had like the best character arc. I think Trip maybe... He was given a lot of depth and nuance that wasn't necessarily there from the get-go throughout the course of the series. And I think he got a lot of real great standout episodes, whereas some of T'Pol's early, you know, standalone episodes are like, okay.
Oh, she's definitely...
Telepathic sexual assaults on Star Trek yet again. Yeah.
She's definitely the character who gets the most like hit-or-miss scripts written for her, but I feel like... With episodes like Twilight or Carbon Creek, like Jolene Blaylock gets material that really grabs people in a way that a lot of the other characters don't get that type of script written for them.
And even, you know, just by the time she's dealing with her fiancé and her mother, you know, like that's interesting stuff, though. That's actually adding like a lot of that kind of layers that we didn't necessarily get to see from her early on. You know, she got a lot of good material by the end of it. I think it just took a while for them to figure out what they had exactly there.
And it was interesting because we just did Broken Bow like a month or so ago. And it was really interesting to then jump into this one and see how much like more confident the character seemed in terms of how they're writing her and how she's behaving on the show. Like, you could definitely feel like that now T'Pol really did mesh with this show.
Yeah.
Whereas in, like, that pilot, it was definitely a bit iffy.
Yeah. So, look, let's jump ahead. We literally into the 31st century with one Daniels who is doing his best to be an extra from the goth club scene in The Matrix with that outfit that he's wearing.
I just thought he was wearing the Borg Queen outfit.
That's what it looked like. It was one, but like, is that how we're going to dress in the 31st century, Cam?
I hope so.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're already getting started based on...
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. I had to wonder, though, like, poor Matt Winston, when he shows up, and they're like, this is going to be your costume. Because this is a guy who's shown up before on the show, but he got to wear, like, the Starfleet uniform, you know, the cool jumpsuit that, like, Archer and all that are wearing on the NX-01. So, like, what is going through his mind when they're like, we have a costume we want you to get fitted for this episode? And they're, like, strapping, like, latex or whatever it is onto him and, like, rubber tubing.
You know what? I think if you want to cash that paycheck, you want to come back for the next episode. You know, the week before, he thought his character was dead, so I guess he's just happy to be around there.
It's just funny because Daniels feels like too milquetoast a personality to put in this outfit.
But maybe that's what they're trying to do, is just give him some personality. But just, you know how some people, you see them outside of work and they don't dress any way that you would expect?
Sure.
That's him. That's not his official, you know, Federation uniform. That's just him, like, out hitting the town in the 31st century.
Well, maybe Matt Winston just wore his normal clothes on the set that day.
That could have been it. Yeah, they didn't realize that he wasn't in costume yet. They just put him on the set after they saw him in that.
He was on his way to a rave.
I like. So, yeah, so we get that cliffhanger that we mentioned, and we come back after summer. Let me ask you this, Cam. Do you think I was on the edge of my seat for the entirety of the summer after I saw this cliffhanger?
Well, the sarcasm in your voice says, no, you weren't.
Minus the sarcasm, would you have been on the edge of your seat if you had to wait for a full summer before? I mean, you did the disc swap.
Sure. No, because I guess there's nothing here that would leave you on the edge of your seat. We did the episode on cliffhangers, and, you know, you look at, like, the Discovery one from season one. It's not story-based, but having the Enterprise pop up, you can see how people would be waiting to see what happens. Where, in this case, you're like, okay, there's two things. One, is Archer going to be stuck in the 31st century forever? No. Number two, is the Enterprise going to get destroyed by Suliban ships? Probably not.
They have to rename the show.
Yeah, exactly. So it's more just like, well, how do they get out of this?
Yeah.
And
but the thing is, you do believe that they are going to get out of it somehow.
You know they are.
Yeah. And so, is there enough tension for you to just be wondering, oh, I can't wait to find out how they're going to get out of this?
Yeah.
I'd say not necessarily.
I think that's also very difficult to set up unless you can deliver something that no one could ever see coming. Because it's very rare that you have a cliffhanger-type moment like this in a TV show or in a movie or something where the payoff is like a wow moment.
Yeah.
You have to be outsmarting the audience in a big way.
What do you think the wow moment was like in Best of Both Worlds, where they fired the weapon at the cube and then nothing happens to the cube? That wasn't exactly a wow moment.
No, it wasn't.
After waiting a full summer to find out what happens.
It's all about the build-up with these types of moments.
Yeah, yeah.
The payoff can never really live up to it.
So come back and... One of my favorite lines in this episode was when Daniels goes into the library and he says, books with paper.
So apparently the Federation destroyed the printing industry.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Who knows what happens based on, Calypso, that short trek.
Yeah.
Maybe good reason. We'll have to find out in a couple months when Discovery premieres.
So here's the question. Without the Federation, the printing industry is alive and well. Is the discs industry then continuing with it? Like, is the Federation the thing keeping discs going?
It must. You know, look, it's an alt future, right?
Yeah.
So let's say, the other funny thing I'm thinking about when it comes to discs in Star Trek was when Zefram Cochran gets into the Phoenix and he pops in a mini disc and starts playing Magic Carpet Ride.
Yeah.
I'm just like, guess they didn't get iPods in your version of the timeline there, sir. But discs, still a thing with Zefram Cochran, still a thing, I guess, by the 31st century, if they're tossing books into fires and like they're shocked by... What could possibly be in a paperback novel? Although I did like the moment where Daniels sees that Archer is thumbing around a book that says Romulan Star Empire.
Yeah.
And he's like, maybe you shouldn't look at that. You know?
Right.
That's kind of a nice shout out.
That just reminds me of a moment in the part one where they're going through the information from the future, looking for like the stuff they need to find the stealth ship. And Reed's like, those are all these designs for Klingon ships. And Archer's like, no, just look for the shuttle, like the stealth shuttle. And I'm like looking at this display, which is the busiest display known to man. And I'm like, how would you focus on one thing?
Yeah, it is a bit of an ask. But hey, maybe Reed is way smarter than we give him credit for.
Oh, for sure.
So this library sequence, I keep coming back to, when they showed us the CG library, I was like, wow, it looked like a scene out of Grim Fandango or something like that. Like, it looked like why not just go to an actual library? Is it actually, are you saving money by building a really bad looking CG library?
You're not saving money.
No, it's just was the question like whether they could like, you know, throw some books on the floor to make it look, you know, like in bad shape? Like, I would have just brought some prop books in or like knocked over like a shelf or something just to make it look like this. You're telling me that there's not a single library in like all of the Los Angeles area that they could have filmed at for half a day?
Well, I mean, we saw John Wick Chapter 3, and there's a big fight in a bookstore. I don't think they were grabbing actual library books and, like, throwing them around.
No, because they're getting ready to burn them, as we saw in the Star Trek timeline.
That's also true. Yeah. But, yeah, like, I don't know why they wouldn't use a real location. I don't know.
Yeah. But I do kind of like the idea of, Daniels trying to thumb through and figure out exactly what happened. And as he explains it to Archer, you know... Daniels is saying, my reality doesn't come to being because you suddenly disappear from history. I think that's pretty interesting, though. Like, the Federation never forms, and I think it speaks to the importance of the NX-01 mission.
Yeah.
You know, like, because as we follow along with the series, I think they do kind of make good on that promise that Daniels is alluding to, in that, like, we see Archer interacting with the Vulcans and the Andorians and the Tellarites. He is an important figure uniting, you know, that little corner of the galaxy.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's interesting. I don't know how I feel about it, but a lot of the drama of this type of thing is like, these things need to happen so that we can get to the Star Trek you all know and love.
Sure.
And that is really the Archer function, in that he does, you know, he is the guy that's going to help build the Federation. And so you get a lot of this, like, what are we going to do? If this doesn't happen, then the Federation won't exist. And that's tough for a prequel to sell, but I actually think Enterprise does it better than most. Not flawlessly, because yeah. it is kind of drained a little bit of drama, because we've seen all the other series, but I feel like they managed to tackle it with a certain amount of drama that, boy, it's tough. Like, it's something that prequel stories really struggle with.
I'll say this, past tense, we found out that if Gabriel Bell didn't go through and lead the Bell riots, then yeah. We found out also the Federation would never have existed.
Yeah.
I have a much tougher time believing that, considering that World War III was about to wipe out like half the planet. And
yeah.
I would say Zefram Cochrane has maybe a little bit more credit for that versus Gabriel Bell, not to take anything away from him.
For sure.
Yeah.
How do you feel, though, about the idea of Archer as this guy who's going to do these great things and help build the Federation, but he has to be told that he's going to do it all the time? Like, would he have done this if he didn't have Daniels there constantly telling him that he has to do this?
See, this is where you get into kind of the timeline shenanigans. And I ultimately think that you have to believe that if there's no interference in the timeline, then yes, he still would have been able to accomplish that. Maybe Daniels was kind of giving him a kick in the pants he didn't actually need. And mm-hmm. I think that could have maybe stymied some of Archer's progress, in that, like, maybe Archer didn't want to be told what was going to happen, you know? Like, maybe mm-hmm. these are lessons he could have learned on his own.
Yeah, because when we think about some of the other Star Trek time travel stories, it seems like they're a little more careful about this sort of thing. I feel like Daniels goes that just a little extra step too far sometimes, where I kind of go like, oh, that's maybe a bit much.
Yeah, but, you know, honestly, I think Daniels, he's emphasizing that he's got a very important mission. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, sometimes I can kind of sympathize. It's like, you know what, just tell them this little thing. Just get it, make the faster option happen.
Sure. Right. I mean, I think for me, a big part of the, you know, what saves it for me a lot is Matt Winston's performance. I actually think Daniels is a really watchable character. So that helps a lot, too.
Yeah, I was glad that the character did return after we saw his untimely demise earlier on there.
Mm-hmm.
They never really explained, you know, how that worked with him dying and then coming back. And then Daniels is very aloof about that whole situation too. And it's
like the ultimate hand waving. It's just like, don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we come back, onto the NX-01, and we have the Suliban, crew that has mm-hmm. permission to search the ship, you know, has one of my best, or one of my favorite line readings in the entire episode, where the, Suliban actor, not Silic, but his lieutenant, comes over.
Right.
They've been looking for Archer, and he says, "He's not here unless he's dead." And it's like, that was very abrupt, sir, you know. So we get it. But then we get into kind of the caper.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I'm really liking this episode, is because we see the crew actually taking kind of their fate into their own hands, trying to get rid of the Suliban crew, trying to escape, you know, their quarters, communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Hoshi loses her shirt for some reason that is very bizarre. Like, it made no sense. She hops out of a Jeffries tube, and her shirt comes off, and she, like, Brandon Braga, you dog, like, what are you doing, sir? Like, this, it served absolutely no purpose, though. It was just like...
Yeah, I mean, I think this was the original intention for the Bishop scene in Aliens, actually, when he's going through the tube. He was going to lose his pants when he came out. But
makes sense.
But no, I mean, it's...
We should have seen Hoshi doing that kind of knife game that Bishop is so well known
for. Yeah.
You know, that
her, when she was at the table with Mayweather.
Yeah. She's a prodigy.
And she's holding his hand down and doing the knife throw while he screams. The thing about this Hoshi scene is, like, I was kind of primed for it because... Before this, I believe.
Whoa.
Is it? Okay, so jog my memory. What happens first? Archer appearing as a giant head to T'Pol, or this?
Archer turns into the Tupac hologram.
Yes.
And appears in one T'Pol's quarters.
Yes. Is that first?
That's first.
Okay, so that really did prime me for the Hoshi thing, because you look at that scene, and, like, T'Pol is, like, not wearing a lot of clothing, and the camera is just like all over her.
Yeah, why are the Suliban interrogating her with like her midriff showing?
I have no idea.
It's
and
just
so
like this very lurky sort of male gaze filmmaking that we're getting throughout this episode.
And you have like T'Pol like convalescing as Archer is trying to communicate with her, and the camera is just checking her out the whole time.
Yeah, I know.
And I mean, yeah, like you said, male gaze. You know, any film students, watch the sequence. There's your perfect representation of male gaze on screen. And so then we cut to the Hoshi scene, you know, a little bit later, a few minutes later. And I'm like, look at what she's wearing crawling through this thing. And I'm like, I've never seen this these clothes before on Enterprise. And then you see why it's that outfit.
It just, it was bizarre and uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay, guys. Yeah, that'll get the ratings coming back. No, and I feel bad for actress Linda Park because, like, there's a lot of these dogs on the Facebook groups that'll just, like, randomly post that picture of her.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and I was just like, okay, guys. Like,
I mean, I guess if we're to be at all kind to this, that we would say there's a little bit of fair play because Bakula is walking around shirtless in the scene where he wakes up in the past for that whole sequence too and looking magnificent, you know.
Oh yeah. So, yeah, you know, that's fair enough
there. I mean, Enterprise is still in that era of like Star Trek is sexy. You
Star
know?
Trek Baywatch almost.
I think it's like you look at how like the scenes they choose to make quote unquote sexy, and that's where Enterprise gets really iffy.
Very iffy. Yes,
but yeah,
I agree.
That
I
Hoshi
agree.
Moment is really dopey. And I think you could pull off a moment like that in like maybe like some sort of broad, more comedic episode. But in this episode, it's so jarring. It does not fit the tone of this episode at all.
Yeah. Does it really even add much levity? Like,
No.
Are you like laughing your butt off as you see this happen to this professional woman?
No.
Yeah. So it's just like, okay.
And it's not like, in a broad comedy episode, you could have where like she lands and then you get like Reed like, whoa, or something. But he's more just like, what's going on? She's like, never mind. It's like, okay, end of scene.
Yeah.
Comic so gold, Enterprise.
We spent quite a bit of time, probably more than anything else, talking about this sequence here.
Well, it's weird.
But what it is part, if you want to give it any sort of head nod, it is showing that the crew working together, trying to overcome this. We have them working with future Archer. And we get one of my favorite line readings from Bakula where one Silic thinks he's talking to future guy and Archer pops out of that portal and said, I said you're an ugly bastard. It's like, I'm just picturing once again Rick Berman behind his typewriter, lighting a cigar, putting on a pair of sunglasses as he writes that line there.
Yeah, it's the type of moment that like I think they drag it out a little too long because I think you would have surprised viewers more if you didn't drag it out of having Silic stand there for like 10 minutes being like, what? What? I can't hear you. What?
Come back to
what?
Me.
Yeah,
I'll
come
do
back.
Anything. I'll
fiddling
do anything.
With knobs. Come back. Huh? You
he
know.
Seemed really desperate for future guy.
Yeah. Like, had it been a little quicker, I think you would have caught the audience more off guard and had maybe that really cool moment you want when you're setting up how did they get back.
Yeah. Where are you at right now with future guy at this point? Like, I would say I was still very curious about his identity.
Yeah.
And I had stopped watching Enterprise, I think, end of season 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I did tune in for the premiere, The Expanse, and of season 3, and I just didn't follow it. The one thing I would do is I would go into the message boards and I just try to see if they had revealed the identity of future guy.
Yeah.
It was never going to happen. And I'm just kind of like, it irks me. It bugs me. I know there are theories about who future guy is, and it's just like, well, ultimately doesn't matter because we never found out. And it was a very convoluted sort of antagonist. And I don't think anybody actually had an idea that they were going to pull the trigger on anyway.
Right. If they'd had a great idea, they would have done it. And the fact that, you know, now they say, oh, yeah, it was future Archer or it was a Romulan, whatever. It just shows that they were not excited about it.
Yeah.
It was more like, it could be those things, but we don't have a story that's that interesting to tell involving a reveal.
But it really tells you that they never really had a plan for this temporal Cold War. They're just kind of, and so that's why when I watch a lot of this temporal Cold War mythology, I just keep saying to myself, like, what is the plan? Like, what are they doing here?
Yeah.
Like, I can't ever, it's hard for me to get invested upon rewatching some of this stuff because you kind of know that it doesn't really add up to anything.
Yeah, and I saw a quote from Brennan Braga that he said they considered doing a reveal of who Future Guy was in this two-parter, but then decided it was too early. which it wasn't too early.
I don't think so at all. I think they had kind of built up this character enough that I think season two premiere would have been time.
Yeah.
Personally.
I think the thing about the temporal Cold War, though, that's really troubling is like when you look at the DS9 Dominion War, it's complicated. Like there's a lot of factions. There's a lot of intrigue all tying this together. But you look at how concise the storytelling is at making it all make sense to a viewer. And I don't think the temporal Cold War ever had that type of focus. Like, I don't think the writers were ever able to sell it in a way where someone could sum it up.
Well, do you know what it was? The motivations for the Dominion War on either side, they were very clear.
Yeah.
I was never very clear what the motivations were on the temporal Cold War.
You know?
So it's just, it's hard for you to kind of watch this. And I'm just, I'm watching season four of Mr. Robot right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been like 2 years since the last season was on. This is going to be the wrap-up season. I'm sitting here watching this. I'm like, wow, there's like a lot of mythology I'm expected to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of like when you get more and more convoluted and story heavy versus kind of simple character motivations from characters that you like watching, I think that's just kind of the easier thing to do. Just like the mythos heavy stuff is just, like, think about the black oil on like X-Files.
Sure.
You're just like, wait, what's going on now?
Yeah, by the time you get to like season seven, you feel like you're hallucinating.
Yeah. You're like, wait, I thought Krychek, what happened to you, sir? Is this like, I don't know.
Yeah, totally. And the thing with like Enterprise is like the Suliban are very much pitched as like antagonists, as like villains on this show. And it's like every story they do featuring them tends to portray them as villains. So we're not expecting like a really murky like, oh, there's a lot of complicated reasons for why they're doing what they're doing. So don't play the whole mystery card. Like, just sell like what it is that someone wants.
Yeah. I'll say this, though. There's one moment where Silic did get a little bit of nuance here, which I did appreciate, where he was actually reluctant to destroy the Enterprise, even though they couldn't find Archer.
Yeah.
And that was essentially his order, though. It's like, destroy the ship if you can't find Archer.
Yeah.
He's like, well, wait a minute. Let's keep looking. And I was like, okay. Like, this guy isn't just like some bumbling buffoon all the time. Like, I was like, okay, like, I appreciated that moment at the very least.
I genuinely like Silic as a character. I wonder, though, if it would have been aided to have another Suliban in there that has personality. Because we get ones, you know, his assistant or whatever in this episode, but that's not like a character who endures over the, you know, couple seasons. Like,
we needed Melinda Clark Saran to come back.
Sure.
You know, like, even though she had died, but like, she was somebody who was kind of distinct and she could have worked for sure.
Well, you look at what they did with the Zindi, you know, a couple seasons later, and it makes a lot more sense when you've suddenly got a few characters on the Zindi, you know, council that we can all kind of put a face to and understand what they want and why.
Especially the squid people.
Those especially are them.
Yeah. So, so ultimately, I've been alluding to this for weeks now. Archer proves the innocence of their ship in the destruction of that mining colony, and he's making the argument why the mission should not be canceled. I had such mixed feelings because in my head, the gazelle speech, the infamous gazelle speech, was so much worse in my memory than it was in reality. It wasn't bad. It was kind of like it was a dopey Kirk-esque sort of speech. It would not have ever gone down as one of Kirk's best speeches, but essentially he makes the argument like, hey, look, gazelles, they can pretty much run along with their families within hours of being born. Humans, we need a little bit more time. Give us that shot. We'll figure it out. Don't worry. It's a bit of a clumsy metaphor, and it kind of feels like you're talking down to the audience quite a bit. Yeah. And I love Scott Bakula. I don't know if his performance was the best. It seemed almost too earnest, and you had pointed out that's actually the appeal of the character most of the time, but this is just a little bit too much for me.
But does it limit his ability to do these big rousing speeches? Because when I think of the other captains, I can remember specific speeches where I was just like, hell yes. With Archer, I'm like, you know, I think the one near the end about the, you know, building the Federation was okay, I think. But like, they don't stick in my mind. Like,
this is the one that sticks in my mind most for Archer.
But that's because it's weird, right?
Yeah.
Because
it's
the gazelle thing.
I just wish that Soval was like turning to his Vulcan companions and going like, wait, what's a gazelle?
Like, I was having that thought. Like, what does, I'm trying to remember, what does a gazelle look like?
Aren't they kind of like antelope figures, like they're kind of like antelopes.
Oh,
or something.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah.
So I don't quote me on it, listeners.
We find out they're a type of bird.
Yeah.
No, yeah. That I think you're right. Yeah, because I don't know. Like, it's a type of speech that, like, it's memorable, I suppose, because it is so weird. But it's not delivered in. It is no risk is our business. That's for sure.
Right.
What did you think of Saval in this episode? We're still at the frustrating Saval phase.
He's still the jerk for no reason sort of phase. And I'll say this: Saval is like, by the end of the show, I really liked him.
Yeah.
This is not the time that I was enjoying Saval when he would appear in episodes. And you could really understand why one Trip felt compelled to start screaming his head off at his admirals and commanders, as well as the Vulcan diplomatic mission that was there talking to him. I was like, Trip, shut up, bro. It's like, let your captain handle this. Because I think it's actually, it's like saying to Archer, you can't command your crew at all, you know. But how is it that we still have, like, T'Pol still on this mission at this point? You know that the Vulcans don't want her there. Do you think they just want at least one Vulcan there to kind of keep monitoring things if, you know, like, it, like I, it's just, it's hard for me to...
I think that's the excuse for the betterment of the show.
Yeah. She ultimately leaves Vulcan expeditionary group, so...
Yeah, like... I really liked her moment here standing up for the crew. I think that's a great character moment. So we are seeing, you know, T'Pol start to work a little better with the crew and why she's going to be important going forward, as well as we begin to see more of her turning against Saval's ideals, which we saw, you know, in Broken Bow, she was very much in that group.
Yeah.
And so I do like that shift. T'Pol also has one of my favorite moments in this episode where she's on the bridge. And Silic is asking, you know, where's Archer? And she just turns and does this, like, really cool, like, turn off the visual.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, so smooth. And I'm like, that is badass. Like, she just looks really cool in that moment.
So, Cam, I guess as we wrap it up here, one thing that we can consider is how this works as a season one finale / season two premiere compared with other series.
Yeah.
Look at Discovery. I think Discovery took a lot of flack for how it's ham-fistedly wrapped up its season one.
Yeah.
Like, that was not a good finale at all.
Yeah.
It came out strong with a good season two, though. And I think it made us excited for a season two.
But also, like, the cliffhanger at the end of Discovery season one is not tied to any of the storytelling in season one.
No, with the reveal of the 1701.
Yeah. So it doesn't feel like the same as, like, this does.
Yeah.
But, I do agree. Like, that season one finale was rough for Discovery. And Enterprise does it a lot more gracefully in that I think you want to come back. Like, I think that's, for me at least, why part one was a little more fun for me to watch, was just the character moments, was seeing so much of the characters. You know, you said the Hoshi Mayweather scene.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get that in a lot of the episodes. And in even, like, the second part, it feels more streamlined to me, where I began to realize, like, yeah, this is much more like the modern Star Trek, where you kind of... get the weird moments out of the way. Like, they don't really happen as much.
It was definitely a much more fast-paced episode, but I felt as if our characters were... The thing I like about Star Trek is watching smart people be smart.
Yeah.
And it felt like the first part, we're watching kind of the wool being pulled over their eyes as they were being tricked into believing they did something that they did not. Whereas episode two, it seemed as if they were taking their own fate into their own hands and being more like active players. And that's what I kind of appreciated. Like, our characters, they look competent at this point.
Yeah. And it is cool seeing them do their little heist thing and Reed breaking into Daniel's quarters and stealing thing. Like, that is fun to see. So, like, yeah, like, I do think this is a pretty confident two-parter for, like, it's not like Enterprise season one was confident. It was actually quite rocky.
Yeah. So does this justify itself? The feature length that we get from it here. That's the question we ultimately want to answer.
Yeah, and with this one, it's almost a tough one to answer, because in terms of what wound up on screen, the two-hour entertainment, it's an entertaining story with a, you know, really solid beginning, middle, and end, and great character moments, some weird stuff that we've mentioned, but overall, pretty satisfying Enterprise story. But in the larger spectrum of Enterprise, I don't know. Does this, like, two-hour temporal Cold War story hold water anymore? Like, do people find it that interesting now?
For me, I wasn't super invested in that.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll give you credit. Like, I did enjoy those smaller character moments that we did get in the first part, you know. Mm-hmm. And so does this ultimately justify itself as a two-part episode? Thing is, if you turn this all into just like a single temporal Cold War episode,
yeah,
I would hate it even more. I shouldn't say I don't hate this episode. It's more of a kind of a middling episode. So
right.
I would say, I know I said, yeah, I guess it does justify itself. And then I say it's a middling episode, but I'd say that there's enough going on here. And I think the idea of their mission being canceled and what they're willing to do to make sure that it's not canceled, I think that's an interesting story on paper.
Yeah, and there is a little bit of like a meta narrative here of like, why is this show important? We need to keep it going. Like, you know, we can't cancel this show after season one. We have to keep going, guys. It's important. And so, like, I do think it's fun for that. I just think tying it into the temporal Cold War stuff almost reduces its how essential it is.
Yeah.
Because when you look at a lot of the other two-parters we've talked about, you know, Time's Arrow, you can say, oh, that's not the greatest TNG one. But because it's kind of a standalone thing, it feels unique. People keep going back to it and wanting to revisit that sort of adventure. Whereas, like, with this one, I feel like it has that kind of that whiff of stink of like, yeah, but the temporal Cold War didn't go anywhere.
So don't you think that they could have told a two-part story about the prospect of them being set up for destroying like a mining colony and the mission gets canceled and it's about them trying to prove? Like, I think you can subtract the entire temporal Cold War element out of it, and you probably would have ended up with a stronger episode, though, and one that still would have been a good two-parter.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. And, you know, you still want that image of Archer in the 31st century in the wrecked future, but you could work that in a different way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, you can't all be a learning curve when it comes to a season one finale. So sorry about that, Enterprise.
Very true. And I just have to say that Archer floating head moment was so strange. We didn't touch on it much when we referenced it a few minutes ago, but like,
I just kept thinking, oh, it's the Tupac hologram, but Archer.
Yeah, like the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, this is so strange.
Yeah, but like it's better that it sticks in our memory than it's like a sequence that like we don't even think about.
Yeah, like you can't say that they phoned in just a, you know, really middle of the road two-parter. Like it does feel like it has those kind of memorable moments. It really did feel to me, though, watching it, that it was a much more streamlined two-parter than we saw in like TNG, for example, where they would have these big stop moments where, you know, characters would just do things that would totally get cut out of the show because of reduced runtime. Because I think part two of this was 2 minutes shorter than part one.
Okay.
So you could tell that they'd already slashed it down to 42 minutes, which is significantly shorter than, you know, a original series or a TNG episode.
You got to get those Tribble cereal commercials in there, man. Got to find time.
Totally. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook at facebook.com/subspacepod. Okay, so Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Cam, we are tackling Star Trek's biggest twists. I think they've done a lot of stuff here in new Star Trek with Discovery. And also, like, back in the old days, a lot of like things we were never seeing coming and what our reactions were. And I think there's a lot of potential for us to ponder what kind of twists could be ahead in all the future series that will be coming on air very soon.
And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of them.
Yes.
Okay, you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vulcan Midriff Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P. P as in paper made books. O-R-T-O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.